This class is a study of the Great Flood, Noah and the Ark. And if you don't have one, please let us know. There were some handouts given out as you came in. Does anybody? It's a set of pictures on a page. And it'll be something you can take with you. I'll explain what these pictures are as we go by. Some of them are in today's presentation. Some of you asked me for some pictures, something to remember the story by. And so if you don't have one, they're passing them out here. Anybody else need one? Need a set of pictures? Now, do any of you need the schedule for the class? It runs through the end of November. Okay. Anyone else need one? Over here? Okay. Would you pass that down? And I have some more. Anybody else need a class schedule? Need another one here? All right. Let me keep one. So those are the only two handouts so far. I was told something that saddens me a bit. Rita Coffey is leaving in a couple of weeks, I guess, right, to go to Lubbock. There's a songbook, a special songbook set aside out in the lobby. If you'd like to write a note to her before she goes, she'll take that book. We'll make sure she takes that book with her. And you can write on your favorite song or write in the back or the front of the book. So we're sorry to hear that Rita's leaving. I guess you're going to be closer to your family. Is that the idea? Well, do come back and see us from time to time. All right. In the last two lessons, this is the third one in the series, we talked about the discovery of the ark. It's been known for 60 years where it is, and it's been looked at and explored and examined, and we talked about the size of it last week. It's exactly the right size. A lot of people rejected it because it looked too big, but then we found last week that the cubit that the people were using in the time of Noah was a bigger cubit than the one that's common in the Old Testament. It's 20.6 inches instead of 18 inches. And so it probably bespeaks the fact that people were a little bit taller in Noah's time than they are in our world. It was discovered by aerial photography. And you wonder, and I still wonder, why people don't readily accept it. There are a lot of reasons why people will not accept the truth, and you've encountered that in a lot of areas, I'm sure. You know something's true and other people don't want to believe it, well, then they won't believe it. And so I guess we just have to accept that. You can see the evidence, and you can either accept it or reject it. I'm going to show you another set of evidence today besides the ark itself, which we looked at and we'll see again today. There's a set of anchor stones, and you have one of the pictures on the page there before you, and we'll look at those. They are huge. They are stones, anchor drogue stones that would hang below the ship to keep it oriented into the waves. And so they are so large, they wouldn't be used, they would sink an ordinary sized boat because of their weight. So, Ron Wyatt. Who was Ron Wyatt? I think although he is belittled somewhat by history as being a little bit overly verbose about what he sees and what he imagines it to be. Nonetheless, he's the one who gave us the basic information about the ark as it was found in the mountains of Ararat, about 26 miles south of the tallest peak, which is Mount Ararat itself. He went there to check on this after it appeared, the picture appeared in Life magazine in 1960. He went with his sons in the mid-70s to go see this site for himself. He was interested. I'll tell you a little bit about Ron White, and I'll show you his picture. That's Ron on the left, on your left. And I think that's one of his sons, although he isn't identified in any of the pictures that I've seen. And the Turkish guide is over on the right-hand side of this large anchor. It is an anchor befitting a huge ship. And we'll see what normal anchors look like in a few minutes. Ron was an anesthesiologist in Tennessee, and I guess he amassed enough money that, as if you've ever had surgery, you know that there's this doctor who tends to your breathing while the other surgeons do the work, and he gets paid too. And so he had enough money that he could go exploring and adventuring later on in life, and so he did this. He and his sons went to Turkey and to the far eastern edge of Turkey where Mount Ararat is, and they were looking around through there, and they discovered not far from the ark itself in a village called Kazan. We'll see that in a minute. About 10 miles from where the ark is, there's a whole set of these anchors that are all in one spot. And I have asked you on the outline to read chapters 6, 7, 8, and 9 of Genesis, because we're going to do that in a couple of weeks and look at the details of the story as it's recorded in the Bible. And we find that near the end of the voyage, the ark came to rest. And when you read that, a lot of people say, well, it grounded. No, when a ship comes to rest, it comes into port and drops anchor. And these anchors were dropped all in this one spot. And then a little while later on, apparently Noah drove the ship aground in a current of some sort. And so there are some of these stones close to where the ship is, but the biggest collection of them is in this little village of Kazan. These stones are something like 8 tons. They range from 5 to 8 tons, I think. They characteristically have a hole near the top where a rope went through, and they could dangle the stone below the ship in the currents that were driving the ship in the storm, in the flood, and keep the ship oriented in the current. And if it was oriented in the current, then it was oriented in the waves as well. When you read the account in Genesis, you'll find there wasn't any wind involved in this until you get to the second half of the journey. So wind and waves would have driven it ashore when it came to the end of its voyage, but during the middle part of it, it was just a matter of currents and waves. So that's Ron, the white-headed one. He died in 1999 or the year 2000. I don't know the exact date of his death. Died of cancer. Died of skin cancer, incidentally, on his forehead. If you have any of those kinds of diseases, that kind of skin cancer, it wasn't melanoma, it was just cancer of the skin, but evidently he didn't take it seriously until it got out of hand and then it metastasized. So don't play with that sort of thing. They say that's a curable one, but it can be dangerous. There are many elements of his life that remind you of Indiana Jones. He was that kind of a guy. And when I heard him speak over at Humble in the mid-90s, he wore a hat like that down over his eyes, and he looked the part. He was shot at. This was a dangerous place to go in eastern Turkey because of the Kurds. We talked about that once before, who didn't like strangers, and they certainly didn't like strangers coming in, and they knew that this was Noah's Ark. And the Turkish government now recognizes that that site is Noah's Ark, and so they just don't like strangers. But anyway, he survived all of that. And they found these stones in a little village near where the ark rests. And you'll notice there's some markings on the stone. You can't see them in this light very well, but I'll show you another one. That's Mount Ararat in, above Ron Stone. Ron Stone is a local hero, isn't he? This is Ron Wyatt. Above his head is Mount Ararat in the distance, and it's covered with snow, as you see, most of the year round. Now, another player in this whole story, exploring and examining this and this artifact, is David Fasold, F-A-S-O-L-D. And he had, this is the same anchor. It's just a different photograph at a different time. And now you can see the markings. There are crosses all over this particular stone. But some of them are marked a little differently, and we'll see that in a minute. And the name of Kazan is an ancient name, and the more modern name for this little village is Arzap. And these names, of course, seem strange to us. They're a different language. The crosses put on the stone apparently were put there by medieval tourists as not exactly graffiti. We'll see that anchor stones traditionally had the name of the owner on them. And it seemed to have been adapted by these tourists to mark the stones with one very large cross representing Noah and some smaller ones representing those who were with him. And then in this particular case, there's almost two dozen marks put on it. Others couldn't help but put their own mark on it too. So it's overly marked. It looks like it's kind of broken on the left-hand side, and it may have been damaged somewhat historically. We don't really know. Many of these stones, people tried to drag them around by putting a rope through the hole in the top of the stone and then pulling it with a yoke of oxen, and that generally broke out the hole. And so many of the stones have broken holes, but you can still see where it was. And the reason for that is that the stone weighs so much. But when it's put in water, it's buoyed up by the water and doesn't weigh enough to break the integrity of the stone in water. But you pull it out on land, and of course it breaks. David Fasold now wrote a book about Noah's Ark. He and Ron Wyatt examined it together in the mid-80s, 85 to 87 or so. And he has a history as a marine archaeologist. And so he knows shipwrecks, and he was a person who salvaged shipwrecks. You remember, you've seen stories about finding a ship on the floor of the Gulf out here that was a treasure ship from somebody, and it's full of gold bullion and that sort of thing. And so he did that. That was the way he made his living, was by examining these wrecks underwater. This one's not underwater, but of course he can recognize a ship, an ancient ship, or the remains of an ancient ship, and he was quite excited about the find. And when he first saw it, he says, "I know ships, and this is a ship," no doubt about it in his mind. It is said that he rejected this late in life before he died, and he also died around the turn of the century. I don't know the exact date. But he had equipment to examine what was in the ark without digging it up. And that was what the Turkish government didn't want them to do. Didn't want them to excavate it because they might destroy it in the process. Now, I think a good archaeologist can take this thing apart and restore it in a sense as he goes at it instead of destroying it. But the Turkish government wants just the right person to do that. And these were all amateurs as far as they were concerned. So they could do some examination of the ark, but they had to be non-destructive in the process. Well, I said this was just one of a number of these anchors. Let's go through that. Here's another anchor that they found. The Turkish guide is putting his hand up there to complete the opening that was broken off, where someone tried to drag it along and the right-hand portion of the anchor stone broke away. They often erected these over graves or used them in a variety of ways. Some, they tried to set them up when they could. And that was at Kazan. Here's another one that was at Kazan. And there the hole is at the top of it, and they sort of smoothed it off. And this one was used as a gravestone, but it has some markings on it. And you can see the markings and in the field books of the explorers here, they made drawings of exactly where these marks were on the stones. And so here's a set of these stones. And some of the crosses were clearly Byzantine. Others were more decorated crosses, as in the upper left and lower right. The upper right one is the one we were looking at in Ron Wyatt's case and David Faso. And it has a lot of markings on it. The other three, however, have one large cross and seven smaller ones. And that's kind of interesting, isn't it? There were eight people on board the ark. And it's thought that the large cross represents Noah. And you'll see, as in the bottom ones here, there are six crosses put with Noah and one outlier off to the upper right or over to the left side. And so they think that that represents Ham and the difficulty that he and his son got into with Noah after the flood was over. But they're not sure. No one labeled them or anything. But there are seven in each of those three cases. And so as though the people who found these stones visited them, it was kind of a tourist attraction, and they decorated them so everyone would know that it was Noah's Ark. It was associated with Noah's Ark. Now, that's visitors in the last couple of thousand years. There's no reason to believe that visitors before then, over the thousands of years since the flood, would use crosses in that regard. There's no particular reason why they should. And so it's thought that, and these kinds of decorated crosses are characteristic of medieval times. Notice that in all of these, except the one in the upper right, the hole had been broken out, but it's the pieces are lying there in some cases, and they can reassemble the hole in those three. They're not quite as large as the one in the upper right-hand corner. It was the largest one. Well, why are they all at Kazan in this one place? It's thought that when Noah put the ark at rest, he anchored the ark at Kazan and then decided to move it. Well, you can't just haul in these anchors. They're too big. Now, you could store the anchors in the bottom of the ark. We're going to see why that's possible today, and release them on a rope. In fact, they could have all been sort of like loading a gun, a magazine in a gun, so that you can fire the bullets when it's appropriate. These anchors could be stored on the bottom of the ark and released at the appropriate time, but you don't haul them back in. So he just cut them all loose when he decided to move the ark. And so here's a dozen anchors all in one spot. He had more than that, evidently. And I think when they ultimately do uncover the ark, they're going to discover there are anchors underneath it that were not used. And so it's plenty big enough to carry dozens of these stones. It's kind of interesting in the other accounts of the Noah and the ark, the Babylonian account talks about guiding the ark with stone things. They didn't know what to call them, but I think that's what they're talking about. You drop these stones into the water, and they are drogue stones. They don't go all the way to the bottom. They let them hang under the ship, and the currents in the water or keep the ship oriented in the current. And that was the purpose of it. Put them at one end of the ship, at the end that's going to go first, and the pointed end of the ship is the end that trails, and that's the end that you want to aim into the trailing waves. Okay. Now here's what anchor stones. These are anchor stones found on ordinary ships in shipwrecks that have been studied in the Mediterranean Sea. There's no doubt about the fact that they were used with ships. And they each have a mark on them, like the one in the lower left and the one in the upper right. That was sort of like the way in the Wild West you identified your cattle with some sort of a mark, a brand. And so these were branded. And then the middle one there, that dark thing in the upper right, is a man's foot for comparison. That one is pretty good size. The pictures were taken independently, so we don't know. You don't have a very good size measure there, but most of these weigh 100, maybe 200 pounds. You don't want your anchor to weigh more than that because you can't pick it up to throw it overboard. It'd take two or three people. 100 pounds about the limit. I couldn't pick up a 100-pound anchor, but maybe some of you strapping young men could do that. And so, you see, they have the hole, but they're only a foot or two in size, 1 by 2 feet and maybe 6 inches thick. And so that's for an ordinary ship. The big stones were for Noah's Ark, which is 10 times bigger than any of these, the ships that these were for. So that's what they are. If we didn't know where Noah's Ark was, the finding of those stones, I mean, they're over a mile up in the mountains, and they fall in a line all the way west through Turkey, and it's thought that one of them, I mentioned this before, was found in Ankara, and one of those large stones, and that's why it's called Ankara, was because of an anchor stone found there. So just finding the stones is independent evidence of the fact that there was at one time an ark. There's no reason to drag these things up in the mountain and leave them. And in fact, it would be impossible to do so with the technology that existed until recently. And obviously, they've been there a long time. Okay. Now, as I mentioned before, the Turkish government recognizes the site as Noah's Ark. And so they built a visitor center there back in the late 80s. And it's still there. You can, if you go in a group or something, you'll find this visitor center sitting on the hill overlooking the Ark. And so there you can see, looks like it's tilted, but it's the angle of the camera. And here's Noah's Ark in the lower left of the picture. Oh, I wanted to point out something here. Here you get a pretty good idea of the lay of the land. You can see this top of this mountainous area is right over here. It's thought that the Ark first landed in the uplands here, and as earthquakes disturbed the soil and liquefied this mud and lava, that it came down from its initial resting place in this gully from the upper left here. So it comes down, the flow comes down this hill and then makes a turn. And that's how, as the ark was brought down in the flow, it was shoved onto this outcrop here of stone. Because it came down and as it was turning, it was pushed against the far shore, the far cliff here. And it got impaled amidships, and so it didn't slide any further down, but the dirt slid away from it with the earthquakes. Now, the earthquake that uncovered it was in 1948. There were a series of 3 consecutive earthquakes in a matter of a day, and all of this dirt slipped away from it and revealed its presence. It didn't rise to the surface. It was there in the flow, but the flow fell away from it. And additional earthquakes in the 70s cleared this side of the ship so that we can see some of the structure there. And Ron Wyatt was quite excited about the prospects of getting samples and that sort of thing when he went back. Now, you'll notice there's some lines on this ship, as you see it here, kind of reflecting in the sunlight. There are people walking on it. You can't quite make them out at this distance. But they were down there working at the time these pictures were taken. And what they were doing was taking, in effect, a metal detector across the surface of the ship and finding concentrations of iron that are abundant in the ship, iron. And you wonder, well, when Noah built the ship, did they have iron? Well, if you read chapter 4 of Genesis, you'll find that they did, and we'll look at that verse in a minute. So they were laying out ribbons on the surface following the pattern of iron returns in the ship. And let's look at that up close. So here you see, as they walked along with their detector system, they laid out these tapes and put rocks on them to keep it from blowing away. And that's the pointed end of the ship, uphill to the south. And it's the same here. This elevation here is this one over here. And so there are people walking on it in the distance. You can sort of make them out, people walking on it here. And you get a feel when you look at a picture like this of how immense this thing is. We've talked about that. I don't know if anybody's gone out and stepped off 500 feet in front of your house, but that's a block. It's a good size block, a tenth of a mile, 515 feet. And so the width of it now, you can see there's kind of a crack down the middle of it. It's kind of filled in now, but one of the earthquakes split the thing open and allowed Ron Wyatt to get some samples from down within below the surface, and also samples of the dirt around it and the samples of material that was rich in iron and samples of material that was not. And so all of that was sent and analyzed chemically, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But they did this with two or three different kinds of instruments. One was a frequency stimulating system in which they emit a frequency to which iron atoms respond, and they could find them that way. They also used just straight metal detectors that work on a similar principle. And so they had they spent several days doing this and looking at the pattern. Now, why does it fall in lines like this? And here where the tapes are off to one side, they haven't, this is where they're working. They haven't figured it out in the other end of the ship yet. But why does it fall in lines? And incidentally, notice here that there are tapes going across as well. See these? Those were pink. They don't show up as well. But there are tapes across the arc where they have found lines of iron. And it's thought that these are not nails. Well, some may have been nails. But mostly they're iron rivets, and we'll talk about that. I'm going to show you some rivets, and you men can think about the thing until next week, and when we talk about the structure and architecture of the ark, you can put your mind to thinking, how would you make a rivet like that? So they're pretty good-sized rivets, iron rods that were driven through to fasten beams together. And that makes a pretty hefty piece of iron. The other thing to think about for next week is where would they get the iron? And we'll see. We'll talk about that more in a minute. All right. Now, that's one way of looking at the patterns in the ship. One thing that they found as they were trekking across and searching the surface of it, they found these remnants of iron rivets in which there's a washer apparently around it, are part of a plate, some of them are not circular, with a hole in the middle and something passing through it. Usually it looks like this. It's turned to rust, the red here, with the remnants of a rivet head in the middle of it. And there's thousands of those. Now, Ron Wyatt was accused of salting the site with stuff he brought from home, but there's so much of it, he would have had to bring a truckload in order to do it. So that's not credible at all. So, rivets and washers. And what they did, apparently, was put a washer on a rivet. Excuse me. Put a washer on a rivet, put the rivet through a hole in a board or a beam and a second beam and then another washer on that, and the end of the rivet was split, and so they would spread it against the washer. And that would a single kind of rivet like this would accommodate a number of different thicknesses of beams, you see. And so, and you don't put just one to hold two beams together. You put six or eight in a circle or in some pattern to fasten two major beams together. And these rivets were put particularly along what are called bulkheads in a ship. What's a ship's bulkhead? Well, there, if you watch Titanic, you know that there were watertight compartments, supposedly, along the length of the ship, so that if it floods at one point, it doesn't get into the whole ship. What they failed to do in the Titanic was to run the bulkheads all the way to the top, and the water overflowed the bulkheads as the ship began to sink. But anyway, the bulkheads, everything is fastened to the bulkheads along the length. And as they examined this by a second kind of tool that David Fasthold brought, before I get to that, the business about iron. Remember this verse in Genesis 4? And people say, well, they couldn't have iron in it because it was long before the Iron Age. Well, that doesn't wash either. Genesis tells us that Zillah, one of Lamech's wives, Lamech is not in the descent from Seth. He's in the other group, the descent from Cain. And he wasn't a nice guy. If you read the section that went before this, he's kind of ugly to the people around him. But he had two wives. This may be, he married two women. This may be the start of multiple wives. Genesis is about the beginnings of things. But one of them was named Zillah, had a son, Tubal-Cain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. This is long before what we call the Iron Age, and of course, scholars who are studying archaeology date things by whether or not there's iron or copper or what, or stone, used as implements. And so they say, well, this couldn't be true. Well, notice it doesn't say that he smelted iron. What would that imply? He's taking iron ore and making iron. But think about the possibility that iron is provided to him in a natural form. And you know, any of you know where you would go to get iron if you didn't want to smelt it? Then all you have to do, if you can find a natural source of it, is just heat it up and hit it with a hammer on an anvil, and you can form it into a variety of things. And so we'll talk about next week a natural source of iron. Any of you offhand know what that would be? Astronomers need to look into that. If you're interested in astronomy, maybe you can tell me where they would get iron. Okay, we'll talk about that next week. So here's the ship. And here again you can see the flow coming down the mountain from the left, thrust onto the rock here, and the gunnels were destroyed where the rock went in, and so that's where you get onto the surface of the ship, is over here at this gap in the side. Now we're going to talk about something that happened down here. You can see where there appear to be rib timbers going vertically here. Now they go straight up and down, but as we look at the camera angle, it may appear that they tilt inward or outward, but they don't. It's just how the camera was held. And we've got three or four of these in a row here, which appear to be kind of lighter than the rest of them. And the reason was Ron Wyatt and his son and a friend of theirs who was working with them went down to see if they could tell more about these timbers on the side of the ship that were exposed. This is where the earthquakes had pulled away a lot of the lava from and the dirt from the side of the ship and exposed this whole wall of it. Now what they did, you can see where these timbers are, what they did was to find a place, and there's a place right here where there's a marker on it, and it's in that area where the where the ship kind of bows out a little bit. There was evidently some special structure here. And so you can find that in the distant pictures. What they did was to fasten a shovel onto a long handle and very gently scrape the soil away from this, say, this structure above Ron Wyatt's head. You can see that it's a little bit lighter than the material next to it. And so they went along and scraped very gently an inch or less of soil off of the surface of those structures to see if what was underneath had any particular appearance, and realize it's all petrified. It was originally wood, but now it's all stone. It's been changed to stone over the millennia by its being buried in the mud. That's important to preserve it, of course. So they did that. And here's what they found. You can see easily where these posts were that make the rib timbers in the ark, and the soil in between them is a little darker. Okay? Those are huge. You saw Ron Wyatt's head. It's about twice the width of his head as he's standing there, which makes them a couple of feet or a foot and a half across. These are big, big timbers, mostly most of a tree trunk. And we have exposed here about half of the height of the wall of the ship, which is 52 feet tall. Not half, maybe a third. Now, the upper edge of this looks almost like it was intact, but it's been weathered. It probably extended further up than we are able to see here. On the surface of the ark, there were some scattered bits and pieces, remnants of petrified wood. And here's something that they allowed Ron to pick up, to dig out, and take for chemical analysis. And as you look at it here, it looks to be layered. There's something here, there's a layer there, there's a layer on the bottom. And he made a slice across one end of it and took some samples. Took the whole thing with him, of course, but he took some samples for chemical analysis, and it's full of organic carbon. They can tell in the analysis whether it's just a carbonate, which some rock is made out of, or carbon that came from petrified material, and it is petrified wood. He cut it with a rock saw and found three layers of material. And they appear to be glued together. I wish I had that picture. I have seen it somewhere, but I don't have it to show to you. But you can see where the glue oozes out at the edges of the material as though he had some kind of glue. And it looks like with three layers here, we have what might be suggesting a mortise and tenon joint where you put a layer of something, another beam in between, and another layer on top of it, and maybe put rivets through it or glue it together. Some people looked at that and said it looks like a crude kind of plywood, which is amazing if that's the case. But we don't know enough about it to know exactly where it went in the ship or what it represents. But it does look as though they had considerable technology when they made this ship. All right. David Fassel brought some other equipment with him. He had two different types of radar. This one worked best, what's called subsurface interference radar. This is still used in our day and age, I think. People looking for things underneath the ground, and some of the equipment today is pretty sophisticated, can go very deep. This was pretty primitive in the 80s. You put it on a sled, like a child's sled. You drag it across the ground, and as it goes, it sends pings into the earth and measures the reflections. And the interference has to do with the frequency of and shape of the waves that are reflected. But what he found was, as they do that, they get a return to the equipment, which is listening for the return, and they get a series of lines on a chart which is moving across the equipment here, and there's ink pens drawing the picture in. Now, we'll take this and turn it over and look at it. Here's the surface of the ark. This is the surface of the top of the ark here. And down below, there are these returns that go straight down. These are thought to be walls or structure within the ark. There's one layer of it down here, another layer here, and then what's on top is all compacted with material that had fallen from the top of the ship. So we think we have the first and second. There are three layers to the structure of the ark. It was to make an ark with three, what do you call it? Decks. Yeah, three decks. And the bottom two decks apparently are there. The third deck is caved in on top of the second deck. And so it seems to be consistent with what the Bible tells us about its structure, and that there is material arranged in vertical rows here, which suggests that these are either the main walls, the bulkheads in the ship, or secondary walls that are separating out different structure. Now, they aren't evenly spaced because the person dragging the thing across the ship didn't walk at a constant rate of speed. That has to be calibrated as you go along and say, okay, from here to here, and they put little marks on the paper as they go along when he passes certain. So they can kind of calibrate it. This is crude data, the way we're seeing it here. Ron Wyatt and David Fassold agreed to a plan of the ship that, as they detected, put all of their data together. Here's the way they think the structure is arranged. This is the way the whole thing from side to side, end to end, is diagrammed. That there are these bulkheads, they call them bulkheads, and at least they're major walls in the ship that you see across here, and they're all numbered. And then there's a peculiar structure in the middle of the ship in the back half, or the front half, depending on how you're looking at it. But in what we would call the stern of the ship, there is a boxed-in area here. And David Fassold looked at that and he said, that's a hull pool. Well, what's a hull pool? Drilling ships have these built into them so that the people working to drill for oil under the ship can go down through the bottom of the ship. If you drill a hole in the bottom of an ordinary ship, it'll sink, of course. But here the hole is walled up such that the level of the water in the pool is the same as the level of the water on the outside of the ship. It won't come up any further than just whatever the level of the waves on the outside of the ship are. And that turns out to be really very interesting and important for a ship that's going to contain thousands of animals. And we'll talk about that next week, because you have to have some kind of ventilation, an exchange of the air. And the water in that hull pool, it gives them access to the ocean through the bottom of the ship. And, of course, they could drop anchors through there. But it also goes up and down with a wave action on the outside of the ship. And if you arrange it just right through the window that runs around the top of the ship, you're sucking in air, blowing air out every time the water level changes in the hull pool. So that turns out to be a surprise and a really interesting technical aspect of the ark. Now, what I've done here is make a model that has a constant width and superimpose it on the structure that we see. And since these bulkheads don't appear to go all the way out to the edge, I think what's happened here is that the ship has been spread through the middle somehow. And so it's wider now than it was originally. But it ought to be 6 times as long as it is wide. It's 300 cubits long and 50 cubits wide. So, if you make a model like that, and it's pretty easy to to just put that together to make a model. It's bigger than this, of course. But you can see the hull pool in the bottom and the window around the top of the ark. And so I've made some diagrams here to show you what that would look like. Now, here is the site. And we're going to superimpose the model on this site, if everything works like PowerPoint's supposed to. Well, no, that's not what it was supposed to do. I wondered how that would do, because I do this on a Macintosh and then project it here on these Microsoft systems, and it didn't give me the fade in. That's interesting, because I thought it would do what it was supposed to do. Let's back up then. And you can see the model is arranged to fit the picture that you have here, and you don't get to superimpose it the way I thought I would. But anyway, there's the model lying in the same orientation as the pattern in the picture. And there you have the dimensions. It's 50 feet high and 86 feet wide, 515 feet long. Now, next week, we're going to take this data that we have, our time's gone today, and we're going to make some guesses about how it was built and what it should have looked like outside and inside, and how that was important to the flow of the story that we'll read in Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9. So before we get to that in a couple of weeks, be sure and read it, because we'll have to go through it pretty fast to get all four chapters in one 45-minute period. But that's the plan. You gentlemen think about, and ladies too for that matter, think about how you might forge those split rods. Because you didn't have metal saws, as far as we know. Couldn't make a rod and then saw it in two to make the split ends. So how do you do that? And the other thing is, where do you get a source of natural iron? And there is a source. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Meteorites, that's right. And so we'll talk about that. I wondered why my interest in astronomy would come into play someday in this whole business, and there it is. So we'll talk. Meteorites, iron, a sizable fraction of the meteorites that fall on the Earth are iron core. Meteorites. They're mostly iron with some nickel in them, and it's like the core of the Earth itself. So we'll talk about that next week. 2 weeks from today, we'll talk about the biblical account. Thank you very much.
I've been thinking about a lot of this stuff. I have something I want you to think about. I haven't reread closely enough to tell if maybe I'm just completely off base.